First of all, thank you very much, Candice, for inviting me to present some of the studies that we are doing at Argonne to present here. And before I start, I would like to acknowledge my collaborators and co-authors. The research results that I will be presenting here has been benefited from the contributions of Margaret Thorne and Bill Riley from Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, Steve Ogle from Colorado State University, and Beth Drewniak, who is my colleague at Argonne. So I want to rephrase some of the statements made in the morning that soil changes with the changing world. And in this presentation, I'll be focusing about basically two kind of forcings, what I call biotic forcing and climatic forcings. So we all know, like, our croplands will not be only supporting food production, but also they have to support the bioenergy production. And in this picture, I'm showing that the corn, soybean type of crop rotation has been converted to perennial bioenergy production such as miscanthus. And in this picture, I'm showing the data from Jim Hansen from NASA. And he compiled the observation-based temperature changes across the world from 1975 to 2010. One process is evident from this picture is something we call polar amplification. That means for the same change in net radiation balance, we'll have high warming in polar areas in comparison to other parts of the world. And in the projections of IPCC, this temperature is projected to be around 8 degrees Celsius by 2100. And because of these processes, we have impacts on soil system. For example, if you take the polar areas, there will be processes like thermokarst formation, that means small lake formation, and a process called thermal erosion. That means the active layer thickness will warm and it will be destabilized, and there will be carbon loss by erosion process. So the important thing that I think is to identify what is governing these, the important mechanisms behind the soil carbon change and the spatial locations responsible for terrestrial carbon change remains a scientific challenge for us. And in this presentation, I will show you different approaches we can use or have been used to quantify the magnitude of soil organic carbon change in response to both biotic and climatic forcings. So these are different ways you can account the soil carbon change across regional scales. So IPCC has very nicely documented by synthesizing multiple studies. And they have categorized three different criteria or approaches you can use. The first one uses carbon accounting approach by taking the reference carbon stock values from FAO data sets and emission removal factors that I will be discussing on later slide. And they have prescribed these emission factors and carbon stocks, and that can be used by any nation in the world to document their soil organic carbon change. In a tier two approach, what you basically do is, instead of using these FAO data sets, you can use the country specific PDON data as a reference carbon stock, and then use emission removal factors from long term studies, those kind of studies that our previous speakers just showed. And the tier three approach is using measurements and a process-based modeling approaches. So what you do in this tier is basically you take observations at multiple times, basically at two times, before your inventory and after your inventory. And you document these numbers as a change in soil organic carbon. And another way to do it is to use some process-based modeling approaches such as descent or earth system models. So the interesting thing is, once you go, the assumption I would say is, once you go through these tiers, the model complexity increases, and prediction accuracy is supposed to increase in predicting carbon change. However, our colleague Steve Ogle from Colorado State did a study, he recently published a study by looking at 191 nations that report their carbon change values and the approach they are using. So basically 80 to 90% of those 191 nations use tier 1 approach of carbon accounting. That includes highly developed nations like Scandinavian countries. And very few nations use like tier 2 approach. And almost no one uses tier 3 approach to document their carbon change in soil organic carbon in response to land use change. So one approach that I will be presenting here deals about to modify the tier 2 approach so that we can have better predictions in soil organic carbon change, which may be qualified or may be capable to produce as good as results as tier 3 approach. So the idea was to develop an advanced and practical approach to assess the carbon sequestration potential through no-till and crop residue retention in croplands of 7 Midwest states, and then quantify the uncertainty in the rate of change predictions. So I have tried to summarize the whole IPCC approach in this equation. So basically what you do is you divide your study area into H different strata, and this each strata is based on the climate and soil variability. And soil variability is characterized like whether the soil is clay or whether the soil is sandy, whether your area is warm or whether your area is cold. After that, you take a difference between inventories at 2 time scale in each of these strata and divide by the number of years, and you will get a value of soil carbon change. So what we are proposing is you can just simply change this reference carbon stock into a carbon stock that has been generated by geospatial modeling approaches, which is popularly known as digital soil mapping techniques these days. And this can be done by taking the P-DONE observations that already exist in many developed nations. And you can use these environmental variables to interpolate those P-DONE observations into your study area. And then these land use management input factors comes from the synthesis of studies. And again, Steve Ogle has published a paper by synthesizing 91 studies across US and Southern Canada that can be used in countries like US. And here RC stands for reference carbon pool, land use factor stands for change factor for particular land use, and management is like whether you fertilize or not, and input factor is how much crop residue you are retaining in the field. So this approach cannot only effectively use to see the impact of residue retention, but there are various scenarios you can use these kind of equations to report your land use change impact on carbon. So this was our study area, basically croplands of 7 states, and we had 18 no-till farming sites scattered across the study area, which covered 4 different kinds of soils, soil at order level, and we had 10 different years of no-till adoptions. And these areas covered 9 major land resource areas of the study area. And this is what we got when we adopted the modified tier 2 carbon inventory approach. So if we have used the IPCC tier 2 approach, would have gotten basically 4 values of carbon change across this study area. But our results are showing that there is a huge variability, and there is a huge range in between each soil orders of carbon change. And we compared our values with the global study that West and Post published in 2002, and their number is within our range. Similarly, Tang and Lau in 2005 published a study of carbon change in Ohio State, and his values are also within the range that what we predicted. And we did a we used Monte Carlo approach of uncertainty propagation to identify the contribution of different factors in the uncertainty, and our results are showing that if you use this advanced approach that I just presented, you can be more confident in your results. That means you can decrease the 95% confidence interval values dramatically by using the soil and site specific these emission and removal factors, and by changing the reference carbon stock. So now the remaining uncertainty is within the management factors, and in order to decrease this portion, we need to have multiple long-term sites that studies the management impact in particular soil type and climate type. And when we validate our results with 18 no-till sites, we found that by adopting this advanced approach, you can decrease the root mean square error by almost half. Now I'm presenting some results of the tier 3 approach that we adopted in entire US croplands. So we did this study by using the community land model component of the Earth System model. And first, we generated the reference carbon stock for entire croplands using CLM model. And this plot is showing the comparison between the carbon stock that we generated for the croplands from CLM with the International Soil Carbon Network data. So the comparison shows that the median values that we generated throughout the croplands is within the interquartile range of the observations. And what we have not been able to do is to capture this heterogeneity that exists in observations. So this shows that there need to be more processes need to be developed and incorporated into the CLM so that we can better capture the heterogeneity of the carbon stocks. And once we developed our carbon stock in CLM, then we looked at the different management scenarios. For example, if you keep the soil in its natural vegetation, that is the green line, and slowly reduce the residues, for example, 90%, 70%, 35%, and 10%, and with or without fertilizer application. So our result shows that once you take out the residue from the croplands, you are basically reducing the carbon. It doesn't matter what percent of residue you are taking out. And the higher residue you are taking out, we are losing more carbon. And our findings are in contrary of other soil carbon sequestration curves that we see in theoretical presentations of scientists like Professor Lal, and whose result shows that by this carbon sequestration curve might go to saturation upon adoption of improved techniques, but we have not figured out that kind of trend in our results. Similarly, in another result, I will show you what happens if we plant miscanthus crop on entire US croplands and how it might impact the rate of organic carbon change throughout the cropland. The idea here is not to convert the entire cropland into miscanthus plantation, but to look at the to identify the areas which will have higher carbon benefit, or which to identify the areas where we don't have to irrigate these plants. By doing that, you'll be basically reducing your carbon footprint. So the objective of this study was to predict the rain-fed biomass productivity of miscanthus on US cropland, and then quantify the potential rate of change in SOC pools due to miscanthus adoption. Similarly, to identify the croplands where miscanthus growth can be sustained to its potential yield without supplemental irrigation. And the reason for our choice of miscanthus was because various studies have shown that this crop produces highest biomass per unit land area in comparison to other candidate crops such as soybean, sugarcane, and switchgrass. So this is the result we have. And this plot is basically showing the soil moisture availability during the growing period of miscanthus across US. And this kind of plot, you can, this kind of data you can generate by taking the precipitation values and the moisture that soil can hold within the field capacity and wilting point. And we first calibrated our model at 260 locations across the cropland and then interpolated with the topography value. And you will get this kind of predictions. We use this map to identify the croplands that would require irrigation and not by taking the crop water requirement of miscanthus and per unit gram of the biomass productivity. So if you do some sort of raster calculation, you can get these kind of results. And we have published these results in Global Change Biology Bioenergy. You can look at the methodological details in that. So what we identified was there are 14 million hectare croplands located in eastern US that can sustain miscanthus productivity to its potential yield without supplemental irrigation. So this is the result of our biomass productivity. So there is a huge heterogeneity, and we compared our results with earlier published results, which is within the range, and we have a very high error in this approach now. So that shows that we have to include more soil parameters to modify our approach. And this is the result that we got from our modeling approach about the soil organic carbon change across the croplands. And again, we compared our results with field observations and modeling studies, and there are various regions that already exist in literature why miscanthus will sequester carbon in comparison to other crops. Now I want to take you to the polar regions. So this is a typical soil profile of Arctic soils with permafrost. And the red line, the area above the red line is the active layer thickness, which freezes and thaws in winter and summer. And Kevin Safer and colleagues reported a positive feedback in this kind of ecosystem due to climate warming. Our objective was to predict associated stocks in different depth profiles across Alaska, to look at the environmental controls and estimate the change in 2100 SOC stocks with moderate emission scenarios of IPCC. So this is what we found. We found that there is a huge heterogeneity across entire Alaska in different depth intervals. And our estimate was in Alaska we have 77 petagram of carbon, out of which is 61% is in active layer, 27% in permafrost, and about 12% in non-permafrost affected soils. The prediction errors that we have are substantial. This is because we have used 472 pedons, and they are very unequally distributed across Alaska. And what we are showing is that our error increases with depth. That means we are doing better job in active layer, but our errors are higher in whole profile in permafrost layer thicknesses. So this is something called active layer thickness, and this map we generated from slope angle, land cover types, and mean atmospheric temperatures. And if you change this value with IPCC scenarios, you can get the values how active layer will change by warming. And our result is that by 2100, this thickness could deepen by 11 centimeter. That means 13 petagram of carbon will move from active layer, from permafrost to active layer. And the loss will be highest in continuous permafrost areas, and the least loss will be from sporadic permafrost areas. So I want to conclude by saying that we have shown from our results that if you combine the IPCC carbon inventory approach with geospatial modeling, impacts of land use change on SOC can be predicted with greater accuracy. Similarly, under moderate emission scenarios, the equilibrium Alaska active layer thickness could deepen by 11 centimeter. That means we will thaw 13 petagram of carbon that is currently in permafrost. And our studies have shown that geospatial modeling in combination with process-based modeling shows a potential to identify whether a land surface will be a source or sink of atmospheric CO2 under changing climate and land use. With this, I would like to have some questions if you have.